Hello and welcome to the EV Cafe Takeaway, that podcast that is focused on the zero emission future that we all hope for. Yes, as always, I am joined by one of the wonderful team in the EV Cafe. And this week I have got the lovely John Curtis. John, morning and welcome.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Oh, buzzing. Absolutely. Somebody from the industry who has been around since God was a boy, knows it all, seen it all, done it all. I'm going to learn loads.
Well, I think we can rest assured that we have an innovator, a pioneer, and a collaborator in our midst, and one that is very knowledgeable about the industry and, of course, the direction of travel, being electric. So I'd like to take the opportunity to say a very big welcome for the EV Cafe to Ian Plummer. Ian, welcome.
Thank you very much, and I'm flattered to have such an introduction. Thank you. Not sure it's wholly true, but I'll definitely take it. Thank you.
Time will tell.
Well, I just...
we will all be judged by time.
I did just want to find out... I did just want to find out what God did look like when he was a boy. But anyway, there we go.
Just look in the mirror, Paul.
We'll leave that one for another day. Well, Ian, welcome to the podcast. The world is a very, very busy place at the moment in the automotive sector, with good, bad, indifferent. What's been your experience, and how did you? Because you know, everybody fell into the automotive sector by accident, right? Or did you choose it? Give us a little potted history of Ian Plummer today.
I'm one of those who fell into it by accident. Very happy to have stayed in it for a long time now. As you mentioned, you didn't quite use the term veteran to describe me, but I've been in the industry for a little while now and seen most parts of it. But I fell into it by chance. I was working in France in a company called Lafarge, in their sort of consumer goods side of their business, in the paint business particularly, doing a lot of international marketing, sales, etc., based in out in France, and got headhunted to go and work at Renault. Renault in France, absolutely considered, still hopefully considered, one of the top employers. So that was a flattering opportunity. Went and worked at Renault and continued to progress very well in France, doing international stuff, marketing, after sales, then into e-business. Evolved really well in a job in Paris, which I enjoyed, although I was aiming originally to move from one country to another one. But jobs kept me in France until the day the number two of Renault called me in. He was my sort of big sponsor there and said that it was time for me to go and do another job abroad, which I thought was great. Although he then intimated that it was to go and speak with the guy in charge of the UK operations, which for me felt like a different step than going further afield and so on. Coming back to the UK wasn't my plan. But anyway, came back to the UK, ran some retailers, stayed in other jobs in automotive, and here I am still there a little while later.
Fantastic. What took you to France? I mean, because archetypally, us Brits don't really get on well with the French, but I note that you took French at an early age and sort of, I'm guessing, must have taken to it like a duck to water. What took you to France?
Well, I studied languages as well as economics and politics at university, and believed myself to be, if not, it sounds a bit pretentious, the sort of citizen of the world kind of idea, but I don't like to think of being a little Englander. I'm certainly not a Brexiteer. When I was living in France, I was asked what my nationality was. I'd usually say I'm a European of British origin. And I firmly believe in the idea that our identity is formed by things other than just our nationality. Having said that, when we play rugby or whatever, I would definitely like to beat anybody, in particular the French. I played rugby in France with a bunch of French guys who took it out on me if ever they could, whenever they managed to beat us. So with that said, though, I am now a French citizen. I have a French passport. Very proud to have that. I'm married to a French lady. My children are bilingual, go to France all the time. Lots of lovely French family. And you are right, we have a love-hate relationship with the French, but there's as much love as there is hate, and it's reciprocal. So there's lots of passion, lots of positivity, although a lot of envy and rivalry as well.
Now Excellent. That's how I love it too.
Ian, I've lived in Scotland for 26 years almost now, and the Scottish love the French love the Scots, and we have the old alliance. and so I have a great warmth for our European neighbours. It's an interesting place to work. Attitudes are very different in France than they are in the UK. And some would say maybe more relaxed, more able to take life as it comes. Would you agree?
Not really, no. I don't think so. I think it's very dangerous to stereotype too much, to be honest with you. I often have friends who tell me they go to, let's say, Paris, could be Rome, could be anywhere, and they say, oh, people are so much more relaxed. And if you ask a Parisian, do they feel more relaxed than the Londoners? They'd say, no way. I went to London, it felt so much better. Everyone felt really sort of cool, and you know, the vibe was good. I think what happens is you go to these places as a tourist more so than a business person, and you see people sitting in a cafe looking like they're having a great time, having a chat, watching the world go by, people watching on a French terrace or whatever of a brasserie, and it feels like idyllic. It is. But that's not what people are doing every day. They're still going into work, and those people are in between work, or it's their day off or whatever. And you perceive things differently when you go somewhere as a tourist than if you're in your daily grind in your own home city. And I'm a firm believer in understanding culture, and to do that, understanding the history, the geography of a place. There's the subjects I studied a lot, still read a lot about right now. And the language, the food, the daily sort of rituals that countries have, I think are really useful to understand. For example, today I love going to Asia, particularly to China, where I think it's the heart of the automotive world. And we got so much to learn from working with people like the Chinese, but they work very differently to the French, to the Germans, to the Brits, and so on. I was often asked when I went from working in a French company to a German one, what the big difference was. And I think for me, the differences are quite linked to national kind of stereotypical views. So the risk of going into those stereotypes, the French culture would be a lot more nimble, a lot more agile, a lot more reactive, a lot warmer, a lot more personable, a lot more passionate. Those are the good sides. I won't do the sort of downsides. It could be a little bit chaotic, a little bit sclerotic sometimes, a little bit haphazard if you give some of the downsides. And the German sort of culture was a lot more rigorous, a lot more resolute, a lot more detailed, a lot longer term in terms of vision. But equally, the slight downsides of those sort of things is hard to move a tanker that's set on the long-term course. If it's on the right course, then fantastic. But the agility, you know, the combination of those things are great. So I try to work on the basis that I've got a multicultural sort of background. I've worked in many different countries, and I like to think I can take the good and leave some of the bad out of all those different cultures and make some sort of melting pot that kind of works.
So tell us, you mentioned works. Tell us what you do for work, because we've not touched on that yet. What's your role and who do you work for?
I'm commercial director at Auto Trader. I'm sure most people out there will know Auto Trader. Quite some distance, the largest digital automotive marketplace in the UK, a tech company in essence right now, the largest really on the FTSE 100, just announcing our results as we speak today to you, and you know, we're doing very well, helping to transform the industry, using our data to embed a lot of very positive solutions to power our business partners, whether they're retailers, brands, funders, etc. We're essentially a place where we try to enable the consumer to find and buy their car more easily, with more speed, more enjoyment if possible, and help the sellers of their car. But not just the car, should add a bike, a van, a truck, a motorhome, a tractor, anything with wheels, basically. Try and help those sellers sell their vehicles more efficiently, smarter, and with more value. So a joining of the largest consumer audience in the UK with the largest cohort of sellers of various vehicles makes an efficient flywheel effect, if you like. And that's the heart of our business. And I'm the commercial director there, engaging with all the partners out there in the manufacturer, leasing company, funder, retailer world that make up the ecosystem that we are quite well embedded in.
And it really is an ecosystem, isn't it? I love that phrase. I think it's, you know, there's so many symbiotic relationships across the piece. And I mean, Auto Trader has really kind of grown in its importance over the last few years, probably since 2017. I don't know, maybe it had something to do with your arrival. But it has. Over the years, it's grown. It's grown and grown. And there is a lot of powerful data that is coming out that really helps shape the future of the market and the decisions that we make today. What are the important things that are coming out that are really shaping the next steps for you, do you think, from the data that you've got?
Well, firstly, in terms of data, there's lots of things to unpack there. You mentioned 2017. I think 2020 would probably be that much more significant, in as much as that was a period where we went into the dark world, the obscure world of COVID lockdowns. We had no idea what a lockdown was until we were in one. And the car market was stuck, of course. And we had already been planning to launch a series of insights, sort of forums and webinars, and accelerated that process at the time. So we found it remarkably important that we accelerate all we could do in that space to give our partners in the industry as much visibility as we possibly could. We didn't have answers to everything, but if we had no visibility, it was important to even say that. But we had a lot of data about what was going on. But very quickly, after a couple of weeks of lockdown, for example, consumers started flocking back to a platform like ours after sort of seeing a big slump to begin with, because everyone was scared and worried about other things. But after a while, demand was picking up heavily, supply was very constrained. That fed through into pricing insights and so on. That fed through into informing our customers what they could do, into also creating solutions to help them sell at distance and use the rules of showrooms, for example, that were shut down, but engaging with consumers and pre-selling, selling, then actually delivering vehicles maybe off-site, all those things that enabled them to keep going. So data can become insight that can become valuable to help power a business decision-making process and then into product solutions. Beyond that, in terms of data right now, we have essentially a data technology platform which enables us to use all the clever tools and insights, taxonomy, 45 years of data experience and so on, all the stuff that powers Autotrader, but to use it to also power our partners. So we share our data either in three ways, essentially, either via our portal, which is the sort of web tool for a smaller customer to engage with all our insights and so on, or on the other end of the extreme via APIs into the largest retailer groups or manufacturers or funders who can take our data directly and then embed it in their own systems. In between that, the third is via around 110 or so tech partners who could be people like TDK or Pinewood for the DMSs or GeForces or Blue Sky for web solutions providers for retailers and so on. And you wouldn't know it, but our data is powering BMW's website. It's powering, I know, Stellantis' website. It's powering the Lookers website. It's powering the part exchange solution on Audi and Volkswagen and so on. So all the things that enable this consumer experience to work well on our platform are now also powering a lot of things in the industry. Back-end solutions about things like business decisions on which car to buy, how much to pay for it, where to sell it, how much to sell it for, what to do to improve its performance and so on, as well as front-end consumer-facing solutions. So data is right at the heart of our business, and we like to try and work very hard to put it now at the heart of everything we do for our partners too.
Amazing. I mean, it's such depth in all of the things that you do, and I wouldn't have guessed, you're right, where your data is being surfaced. I think one of the things that, of course, we at the EV Cafe have been very aware of over the last few years, as we've watched, is so we've got data on the new market, but also a lot of insight is coming out around the used market, both. And the two areas that we've been really, really concerned about is cars, of course. I'm less so bothered about cars. I'm very much more bothered about vans. I know, boring, right? But it's so important. And I think both elements are really, really important. What are you learning about the used values on, you know, in both those? I mean, you may not be close to any or all of it, but, you know, what can you surface that we're learning?
Essentially, that we start off with an electric product, car or van, that is too expensive, that is coming down in price, and that has lots of newer products finally coming into the market that are in the more affordable categories for a start. I'm talking categories and buckets of types of vehicle or price bandings, as well as at a median level, with a lesser gap to their ICE equivalent. So to explain what I mean by that, 23 percentage points is the gap today between a new ICE vehicle and its EV equivalent. So the EV being, unfortunately, 23 percentage points more expensive. That gap is big. It sounds worrying. The good news, to spin it more positively, is that that gap came down about 13 percentage points in the last a bit more than a year. after having stalled at around 35, 36 for a couple of years as manufacturers brought out new cars, but they had the supply chain shortages that meant they put out cars at higher prices and probably slowed down their own journey towards price parity that we need to get to sell new EVs more more rapidly, but to get the mass market democratization of EVs really happening. So if you start off too high and you put the car into the market, you might have some discounts that are higher on the new product. They are. New EV discounts are usually, at the moment, they're around 11.5%. That compares to about 8% for a nice new product. But the RV gap is going to be substantial, so that doesn't necessarily help your monthly payment. And that gap comes from the fact that when that vehicle enters the used market, it very rapidly will drop to a price parity point to its ICE equivalent. Because it's only at that point that the market is capable of absorbing the quantities of used EVs that are coming at it. And it absolutely can, by all accounts at the moment at least, absorb those vehicles. Because they're turning, last year EVs turned a day faster than petrol, 2 days faster than diesel. The fastest turning segment of all was 2 to 5 year old EVs. So at price parity, they are an effective solution where people think it's rational. It makes sense to buy that EV product. There are still fears about battery reliability and things like that get in the way a little bit, but they're relatively minor. They know there's a cost of ownership sort of benefit for many people. 85% of people we can see today that buy an EV are buying it with home charging solutions in play. So they do have a utilization cost benefit. But when you get to answer the point finally around the depreciation, but when you get to the second year of a vehicle in life, all the way through to 5 or 6, the annual depreciation at that point in percentage and pounds terms is very similar to the ICE product. The trouble is that because they start 23 percentage points higher than the ICE product, they come down, both of them, to a very similar level after year one and into 2, 3, 4, 5, because they have to come down rapidly to be able to absorb that supply. That therefore means your first year of depreciation is vertiginous. It is a heck of a steep drop. It always is, but it's even steeper on an EV. And it's that problem that we need to address more fundamentally than hoping somehow that the used vehicle prices of EVs will go up. They won't. I don't believe that's possible. They're now trending slower plug-in hybrids, etc., very similarly to ICE equivalents. What we need to see, the whole market, new and used, to work more effectively, is that the cost of production and then the cost of sale, and hopefully therefore also the margin for the manufacturers and retailers, can be maintained, but the cost needs to come down so that the price can come down so that you can enable more volume. It's not somehow some wishful thinking idea of depreciation percentages fancifully improving because people all of a sudden are going to spend a bit more money for a used EV. I don't think they will. They're happy to buy those used EVs, but at the rational price parity point.
So presumably for new vehicles, Ian, that means that China will have a major impact on the new cost of vehicles coming from Europe. Europe will have to respond in some way to the competitive threat and challenge.
They will, and I think that's a big benefit that we see for the consumer right now, and the fact that we have a pretty open market. The Chinese, but not just the Chinese, and we often hear this sort of thrown out there as if there's something therefore big and scary about the Chinese manufacturers, and it's somehow just them. Tesla did exactly the same thing. What Tesla did as well was rethink the car. They rethought the design process, the production process, and the whole sort of technology integration in the car. So they didn't have the sequential process that we have historically had that lasts, you know, many months. You know, your design and build process for a car in legacy world is like 5, 6 years historically. Yeah. It's coming down a little bit now. Tesla rethought that. They simplified the production process. You didn't have as many joints to weld, didn't have as many parts to fit. You could develop the chassis, the skateboard separately to the front, the back, the top, and the software, and integrate those things sort of in parallel lines further down the road. So much shorter, much quicker, much cleaner, more cost-effective process. The Chinese have done very similar. They've rethought the chassis of the vehicle. They've integrated the batteries themselves, often, for example, seem to be in the chassis. They can shift those vehicles from, well, the chassis can adapt to a plug-in hybrid, to a range extender, to an electric, based on how the demand's evolving. Modularity is key. Vertical integration, scale that they've managed to generate. But the Chinese have really led the charge in this, forgive the pun, totally not intended. But they've led the charge and shown the way. And now what I'm seeing is the real benefit of their products coming in, consumers liking it, and that, like you say, stimulating the benefits of competition. If you're a free marketeer, and I am, yes, I like the fact that it's good for the consumer to have better products, more affordable products coming into the market and more choice. The consumer, and what we can see right now, is liking that. But I can also see the benefit, as hard as it may be in the short term, for the sort of legacy brands, as they're sometimes called, to get a little bit of a rap on the knuckles to have their margins and their share of market sort of nibbled away at in order that they react. I think that the opposite is fearful for the US manufacturers, because they have a wall erected around them. They won't see that competitive pressure in their own market. And they're not necessarily ahead of the game in some of the products we're seeing coming into Europe. So for many of our manufacturers, as tough as it may be, overall, I think it's a good thing.
One of the things that I ordinarily would say is that people can make anything a success. They have the ability to either kill it or make it fantastic. But with Auto Trader and with Tesla and with the Chinese operators, it's not just the people. You systemize what has previously been a complex thing and make it much easier. Auto Trader do that by default. It is not a hassle for me to research a new car. It is a joy because you make it so simple. And it really doesn't matter whether I need a tractor or whether I need a Renault Twizy. You make it simple, and it's the same approach across the piece. Doesn't matter how I interact with you, I know what I'm going to get. That's genius, isn't it?
It's the result of a lot of very smart product engineers, data scientists, and folks who've been hard at it for many years. It's not an easy thing. We have a huge data set built on taxonomy and search filters and so on that are refined over time. A heck of a lot of A/B testing, hundreds of releases done every week. Manufacturer world that I'm used to, if you did a release every year on a given set of software, you'd be delighted and you likely never would. But it's a very different game. So the agile word is overused, but it very much is a test and learn, iterate kind of journey. And we are, as I said at the outset, always focused on trying to make sure that we make things easier and more enjoyable for the consumer and smarter and more efficient for the seller. Now, we know as well we haven't cracked that journey. A lot of people still find car buying fastidious, frustrating, challenging. And to be honest with you, in many ways, it's getting harder right now. So we have to work harder. The consumer is more confused. They're more disloyal. That sounds like a nasty word, but they're just more open to looking at new things, especially when they're going electric. Electric loyalty on new car buyers is half, 19%, half what it is for ICE buyers. That's around 40%. That's based on a large sample, by the way. Last year, we had our new car, the Year Awards. We had 12,000 new EV buyers, 200,000 overall buyers. And those loyalty levels are therefore quite substantial in terms of the sample they're based on. I don't even know of anybody that's got a similar sort of sample in something, any sort of equivalent research. We're just doing the same again right now. 20,000 EV buyers. We're just digging into the results of what that's going to show us. But by all accounts, the loyalty factor is not getting better. But if you add into the fact that you've got different fuel types, different brands, there are more than 70 brands operating in the UK right now for a 2 million market. Talked about competition a minute ago. That 2 million market historically used to be 2.5 million for new cars, but there were 45 brands, not 70, 45 in just in 2019. That's more than 50% growth in 5 years. Mm. We've got another 10 or so coming that I've met up with in China at the auto show in Shanghai last month. So it's hard. You know, some people have heard of BYD, some people haven't, but it's another thing to get used to. Some people have heard of a Golf, most have. Not many have heard of an ID3 or a BZ4X or an ENY1 and so on. And they don't really know all the things about an electric car, how to charge it, what kilowatt hours actually means. So there's so many things out there that we have to try and make simpler. And to your first point, we try very hard to standardize so that you can compare products. That's what consumers want to do.
Yes.
They compare typically 17 different brands when they're shopping for a new car. Brand marketeers don't like to think like that. They like to think that somebody's going to wake up in the morning and think of, oh, I'll go and buy a brand new Audi or something, and I'll go onto Audi's website and turn up at an Audi dealership. That just doesn't happen. It really doesn't happen. Auto Trader is literally 50 times bigger in terms of time spent on our site than the sum of all the manufacturer websites put together. That's what people do. When you go on holiday, you go to Booking.com or Skyscanner and so on. You don't necessarily go to the hotel website of a place you don't know, unless you're going to a place you've already been to, of course. So the whole point about making things simpler is that we have to work ever harder to help people understand the things that they don't even know that they need to know about cars that they don't even know because they haven't heard of the brand or the product name. That is a continuous challenge that we are not arrogant enough to say that we've fully cracked and that we are nonetheless fully focused on.
It's interesting you say about that that last element there where customers don't know what they need to know. And I remember being part of a BVRLA LCV committee, and we were talking about electric vehicles, and this was 2019. And some bright spark, and I can't remember who, said, I tell you what, let's ask the fleets, let's ask the customers what they need. We're like, no, let's work it out what they need. Let's look at the horizon and give them the information that we know that they need. How are you seeing the future? Because, I mean, Shanghai Automotive was no doubt like a trip into the future for the UK, for sure. How are you getting that information that's on the horizon, and how are you then bringing it to the consumer? I mean, obviously the website and so on, but how are you translating that and getting it out to the people, and what do you see in the future?
That's a very broad question. I'll try and break it down a little bit. But first of all, what I see when you go to the Chinese example is that the market there is way ahead of ours. By ours, I mean the rest of the world is way ahead of the rest of the world. It's way bigger than the rest of the world, and it's moving faster. Since it's already ahead, let's say it's here in terms of where it's ranking in terms of scale and, you know, technology and so on, and going at this speed, and the rest of the world going at this speed, it's ahead, and it looks like it's going to stay ahead for a little while. And when you look at EVs particularly, I mean, if you're in the big cities, the tier one cities, the likes of Shanghai, Shenzhen, Beijing, etc., you see on the roads a majority of vehicles are electric. The majority of sales are electrified, at least, the NEVs, as they're called over there. And you go to the show and you see, a whole host of amazing products. I mean, each stand is full of 15, 20, 30, whatever products, not all purely electrified, but the majority are. And again, some are range extenders, some are plug-in hybrids, etc., and some are, many are BEVs. But it feels like there's a base level now where, of course, your EV is at price parity. Very often they're even cheaper than ICE equivalents. And of course, the range is good. And nobody really worries about the range in China. It's helped by the fact that the charging cost is the same wherever you do it, and it's pretty available. It's not perfect either. There are challenges also over there. But the technology is considered, of course you've got good tech. Of course you've got lots of screens. They're amazing. They've screens at the front, screens at the back, usually like four or five in the overall car. The comfort factor is great because they want the car to be like a third space between your car, your home and your office. You spend a lot of time there, so you want to be comfortable. So those are all givens. And if you don't have those things, like if you're considered, as some of the Western brands have been, to have, let's say, weak software, you won't sell your EVs, and they aren't. There are no Western brands now in the top 10 of EV players. Tesla used to be there. They're just falling out. And the Chinese brands are dominating the market because they're dominating EVs, and EVs are growing, so the direction of travel is pretty obvious. But my point is that's the base level. And if you don't have the base level, forget it. You won't sell. The new level that they're working on and talking about increasingly over there is about autonomous features. So you're talking, and I've never really seen much progress in autonomous until recent times. You know, there's people like Wave doing a great job over here, Waymo doing a great job in San Francisco, pushing the boundaries, testing new things, leading the way. But it still feels like a little bit further down the road. But level 2++ was one of the buzzwords of my time in China that I heard most often. So an awful lot of focus now on ADAS technology into the car. So the future feels like an electrified product that is more enjoyable to sort of spend time in rather than a car you're going to have a petrol head type experience in. Yes, we all know the torque and et cetera in an electric car is great, but if you can flick a switch and be in autonomous mode, still eyes on in a city because the city enabled it, and I think the Chinese will create that framework to enable their industry to progress fast and in ADAS and so on. And then you can get on the highway, and again, you've got adaptive cruise control today, but if you can go a little bit beyond that and be eyes on but hands off, then fantastic. Come off the highway, imagine in the UK, come off the M1, and then you've got to take back control. It'd be fantastic. I'd love to do that. I think that will happen quite quickly now in China, and that will accelerate the journey they're going on in terms of technology adoption. But what really stands out now in the Chinese market is the price lever has been pulled, and the EV trend has been massive. We know that they're selling half of their vehicles over there that are electrified. But the differentiation now is coming more from the features and the tech in the product. McKinsey showed some very good data that showed that there was a 3 times bigger elasticity effect by adding in technology generating more demand and sales for your product than adding a price factor. Since they're already at price parity, it's hard to go much lower and so on. Well, BYD have been pushing that agenda just recently, the last few days, as I'm sure you've heard. But if you're instead, as BYD, quote the same example, adding in the God's Eye technology, you're creating a wow factor and a bragging factor that the consumer clearly likes over there. It creates a bit of a snob factor to have the eye above your car, whichever model it may be, whichever brand it may be. But by doing that, you're also eliminating the profit opportunity of like Tesla selling FSD and Audi selling adaptive cruise control for £2,000, £3,000, £5,000, whatever it might be. So that feels like a clear direction of travel, which if it's happening over there, it's very likely to come over here pretty damn quick.
Ian, as we've been speaking all along, I'm slightly dropping my jaw. Your capacity to take on information and importantly, rehearse it back to us in a way that actually we could understand, you know, words of 6 year old. but it is quite incredible, and it's causing me to reflect. I mean, we love to get in, you know, behind the person here at the EV Cafe. We know about the importance of, you know, particularly COVID taught us this, you know, the importance of relationships and getting to know people. Ian, you're quite outstanding in your ability to kind of do this. As you were growing up at school, we know that, you know, you lived in Gloucestershire, and your favourite vehicle, you can maybe tell us what that was and why. But what were you thinking about, you know, your future? What were you looking at? I know free thinker, wanting to go out into the world and all of that good stuff. But what did young Ian Plummer aspire to be? And does this represent it? In any way?
Well, daunting question. Okay, I'll try and give a coherent answer to that as well. Probably more at home talking about autonomous cars in Shanghai. So a young Ian Plummer probably had 3 or 4 ambitions. One, like many young boys, it was to be a footballer. I was okay at football. I was never quite cut out to get beyond a sort of a county level of playing football. But that was definitely, to a certain point, my dream. Not unusual in that respect. Second, you mentioned a minute ago, as a Gloucestershire lad, I have spent a lot of time in summer holidays working on farmland and so on. We had various animals in at home. We had a field, we had horse, sheep, hens, geese, donkey, dogs, cats, etc. So I loved animals. My favourite vehicle on the wall behind us that we just talked about a minute ago, where everybody at Auto Trader in our London office were able to choose their favourite car, and we stuck it in this sort of display case. Mine was a tractor, and people asked me, which model do you need to find? And my only requirement was it had to be a red Massey Ferguson, but any red Massey Ferguson, just love them. So my summer jobs were often spent doing, when I was a bit older, driving the tractor, doing things like harvester activities, baling, whatever, cutting hedges even. Hardest job ever, cut a hedge. See those guys driving along the road, looking at where they're going, half in a ditch with a blade this way and another one that way. It is the hardest thing, but levers and, you know, it's a boy's kind of dream when you've done that sort of stuff when you're a kid playing in a sandpit, to be able to go and do it. Anybody's dream, boys, girls, anything. But it's just something, if you like the engineering side of things, I'm not an engineer, but the playing around with it was great. So that's the second one. That never really worked out, but I could imagine myself when I was younger actually being a farmer. I did envisage it briefly. Third ambition was to be a politician. I wanted to change the world and had an internship at one point in Brussels in the European Commission, wanted to work in that world, but it then just felt too bureaucratic, whether I was going to be local sort of MP based or whatever. Just thought that it was too treacly, the ability to change things as fast as I would like to, and I would be frustrated by it. So then, and this is where I did get to, I wanted to be involved in business, but for me, business was either two things, either very local or it was international. And I liked the idea of going and doing an international career, which I headed off to do when I finished university and started off in France, aiming to go to many other countries and ended up staying in France, but spreading from there to many other countries, working internationally all the time, but not actually living and working in all those different countries that I had in mind. So those were my ambitions and drivers back then. A varied list, I'd say.
Indeed. And so I have to ask you a very important question, which I'm sure all the listeners are wanting to know. If you have anything to do with farming, you probably have watched Clarkson's Farm and maybe understood his decision to buy a Lamborghini tractor. Do you have any kind of opinion about this Lambo tractor that he's bought?
Funnily enough, I haven't watched the series hardly at all. In fact, I heard about that story. I think his passion for vehicles and the idea of buying a Lambo tractor, I think I totally respect that. I'm just not a big fan of that kind of series, if I'm totally honest. And I think they did a great job in Top Gear and clearly doing a great job with what they're doing. It's just not what I prefer. I'm not a big television watcher. I tend to watch on a screen either sport. I love playing it. I still love watching it. Or a film every now and then. But I'm not a big documentaries. But I'm generally not watching much in between all of that. Too busy with other things.
To be fair, neither am I. It is one thing that has caught my attention. But anyway. John,
that was exactly where I was going. So here is a man who has a huge capacity for information, highly articulate, clearly very driven, delivers results, because if you didn't, you wouldn't still be in the job you do. I suspect there's an element of stress in your life. How the hell do you relax?
Good question. I love sport, as I mentioned. I play it. So I play football a couple of times a week with a seven-a-side team in London where I live. I cycle to work. I enjoy cycling when I train up to Manchester, usually most weeks, where our head office is. But I cycle through London, go to work and back again. I find that's a good release, a good way to start or finish the day. I run two or three times a week as well. In the summer, I'll play tennis. I'm a very bad golfer. I'll play that by once a year. I probably get more stressed by playing it than not playing it because I'm that bad. It's that inconsistent. I hit one good shot and think I'm Tiger Woods at the next. And oh my God. And then go to the next one thinking I'm going to thrash the hell out of it and get it back to Tiger Woods and make it even worse. And so, no, generally watching sport, I'm a big Arsenal fan and Saracens fan. So I live nearby. I'm able to go to Arsenal with my son, which I love doing. So Saracens as much as I can. So watching and playing sport is probably the biggest thing. Otherwise, big foodie, love enjoying food usually made by other people. My daughter's an amazing cook. So is my wife. My daughter is sort of Ottolenghi incarnated. She's amazing and love going to restaurants, spending time with friends. It's not anything particularly unusual. Travel will be the other biggest driver. I'm a sort of work hard, play hard kind of person. So I like the activity any given day, the play hard bit after a hard day of work. But I like the going to travel in different places and being exposed to different cultures side of things and carving out the time to make sure I do that is really quite important to my own balance, yeah.
What do you see as the future? Going forward, here we are at a point where, you know, people are reacting to political messaging to make decisions about which car they might buy. And I think specifically of Tesla or indeed China. You know, I'm not buying one of those. It's a story as old as time. The future, will we be more open and more embracing of the new, the different, the slightly challenging maybe? Because this is all about people. It's all about human behaviour. And you probably more than anybody understand the psychology of our industry. What's the future look like?
So another big question, isn't it? What does the future look like, Crikey? So in your various points there, I go back to the car side of things and the consumer angle on what you just mentioned around politics and so on. From all we can see, Tesla, for example, still has a big following. They represent about 20% of all the used EVs on our platform. That's essentially the result of the fact that they were selling a lot of new EVs a lot quicker and in greater quantities than other people, so they flow through into used cars. And they're still doing pretty well on new cars on our platform too. So there are people, though, who are concerned by political aspects of what Elon Musk has been saying and doing, and I'm sure that is denting sales to a degree. But there's still a big following, because the main point in all of this is that they are great products and that the UK consumer generally is a pretty brand agnostic person in the majority of cases. And if the product is good, and hopefully also if the brand is trusted, then the consumer appetite will be high. I worked through Volkswagen's Dieselgate crisis and saw how the UK Volkswagen customer was still very much a fervent Volkswagen product fan. They felt that their trust in the brand had been dented, but put in front of a situation where they could buy another Volkswagen. We did put some loyalty bonuses of a certain amount, £100 for a smaller vehicle to a couple of £1,000 for a bigger vehicle. So if you want, you've already got a Golf, would you like another Golf? Well, yeah, it's a great car. I'll give you a couple of £100 on top of the let's say deposit contribution that was in place already. Would you like one now? Yeah, definitely. Do you trust the brand? Well, not as much as I did, but I still want to drive the car. It's a fantastic product. Another example of that would be if you were to ask the average UK car buyer out in the street which country they would put as the one behind certain brands, I don't think you'd get the answers you'd expect. So, and therefore, I don't think it really changes their perception of things. So Vauxhall, well, that's UK. Well, no, it's not. It's France. Ford, that people would often think Ford's British. Well, no, it's not. It's American. We know that has been for a long time. But then you'd say, well, Lotus, that's British, isn't it? Well, no, that's Chinese. Well, JLR, that's British. No, that's actually Indian. You know, you don't really know, and you probably don't really care. And I think that the UK consumer is therefore very much more focused on the quality of the product and what it can do for them. And we don't have this sort of same principle that maybe the French or the Germans do of national champions and national bias. The Chinese equally over there, they're buying a lot of Chinese product, but by all accounts, it's not because they're nationally focused. They just rationally see them as better cars, and they are. The cars that they're buying are, in essence, in terms of EVs, in the vast majority of cases, better than what else is on offer. So I think the future is still very much more open if we as a country stay open to always accepting that access to the best products is good for the consumer and in the long run good for our industries and so on as well. And we're better off focusing on at being brilliant at the things as individuals as much as a country, brilliant at the things we're going to be brilliant at. Like, we're brilliant at service industries. We're unlikely to ever be brilliant again, forgive me, anybody in the shipbuilding industry, at building ships. That ship, in inverted commas, sailed a while ago. The Koreans, by all accounts, the Greeks, they happen to be really good at those things. But let's not fight that cause. I think the American approach at the moment is a little counterintuitive in as much as trying to reindustrialize things that have long since sort of flown the nest. Mm. And I hope that answers your question. I think it does. Staying open, staying free market-driven and obviously tempered by the right frameworks and the need to make sure that we adjust for fairness where required in a free market. I'm talking about being some sort of neoliberal. But I think the future opportunities are good for the UK if we continue on that track.
Mm. Thank you.
Fantastic. So, I mean, I apologise for this question. Not quite as much as the Clarkson question, but yeah. But the world that I inhabit is a commercial vehicle world, right? So vans and increasingly so trucks. And we feel that there's probably quite a lot of challenges in that sector. Do you see that? Is it clearly a segment that needs help? Or do you think it's you know, moving now and the momentum's increasing? What does the sort of auto trader world kind of give you in terms of insight on that?
Do you mean particularly regarding the electrification of those industries, those sectors?
Yes, yeah, particularly, yeah.
You're quite right that there's plenty of challenge there. I think in general, I am a relative optimist in life and in the industry sort of context as well. I do think that there are so many opportunities that we had probably, like I mentioned earlier, don't even know exist today because nobody's yet sort of untapped them, that entrepreneurial spirit will unleash numerous new areas of growth in the years to come. Because we're talking about a massive industry shift. You know, we've driven, well, we've built, sold, and driven the same kind of car for a century. We're changing the way that works, but it's not just cars, it's vans and it's trucks. They're going to need to change. And as that happens, you create a whole ecosystem, to use that word again, around that change that spurs innovation, creates entrepreneurial opportunity, and so on. So, for example, I am a believer that with trucks, we will probably need different battery type solutions and probably some hydrogen solutions to enable the largest vehicles to be using cleaner forms of mobility. But vans, I think that there are a whole host of product coming onto the market right now that give a lot more optimism that we have a clearer direction of travel than has been the case in the last few years, where it felt a little bit stuck. We didn't have that many good products with proper range, payload, and so on, and affordability. Renault announced some great products just recently, three new products coming to their range with Flexis supporting as well, looking for the big fleets that need extra service. I think their concept is great. Kia coming to the market with five altogether products potentially coming through. The likes of Verizon, Geely coming along with a new product. There's new innovators coming in that will spur, I think, the direction of travel we need to see the commercial vehicle industry going on. But I'm sort of optimistic we might do things a little bit differently as well. To give you an example, I know this is maybe a bit London-centric, but cycling through London, I do notice often the last mile delivery, there's even a company I see frequently called First Mile, that have a lot of cargo bike type solutions. So you can have your Laundry Heap, which is a good startup you might want to check out, that pick up your laundry and take it away, bring it back in a cargo bike kind of container. The First Mile people, they'll do the refuse collection in big trucks, electrified product, but they'll also have cargo bike versions picking out bins and taking them away. So I do believe that we'll have a different set of solutions whereby you won't necessarily see so many large commercial vehicles going into cities. They'll end up dropping things at the outskirts, and you'll have the last mile being done by maybe different types of solution. Potentially trains can play a role in that sector as well. But to give you an example, my daughter's at university in Oxford, and she told me a few months ago about a change in policy that they announced where Amazon packages historically were being delivered by numerous different couriers into each of the colleges multiple times a day, you know, often with one package in one delivery van. So it's a highly inefficient use of space and, you know, road efficiency. And now the principle has changed whereby all the deliveries need to go through the day to the park and ride facilities that you have on the outskirts of Oxford. And then once a day, each college has one delivery coming in from that those park and drive places in an electrified product of some sort that takes all the packages from whichever retailer, from whichever courier delivery system that have arrived into Oxford. So one delivery into the city centre for each college. So I don't know how many colleges there are, but that is an infinitesimally smaller amount of vehicles on our roads, which is a different way of doing things. And that's probably good for the environment. It's good for congestion. It's good for the ability of more Oxford citizens to cycle as well safely. But it will entail different solutions in the commercial vehicle environment where you might need two products to do slightly different things, whereas historically we had one that did a bit of everything.
Brilliant. I very, very well articulated. There's nothing I can't agree with there. And I love the insight of linking, particularly that Oxford scenario there. That makes so much sense. I mean, I probably get three or four parcels here a day, you know, at different times in different vans, some diesel, some electric, you know. And it's that kind of thing that we need to innovate and solve. And I love that entrepreneurial optimism. Yep. That says this can be done. I think, just don't know how yet.
I agree. I think we as individuals need to do the same. I think the sort of hybrid model is the one that we are often intuitively using without necessarily consciously thinking about it, but I think it will happen more and more. In other words, you might live outside of London, come to a meeting in London. You might take your e-bike to the train station and get on the train. Maybe take your e-bike if you fold it away, let's say, to Brompton, put it on the train, comes with you. But if not, you leave it there, you get on the train, you get into London, you get on a line bike, complete your journey over here and so on. It may be you take an electric car to the park and ride and then come in on a coach or whatever to the city, into Oxford, wherever it might be. But that combination of hopefully electric car, public transport of some form, maybe a bike, electric bike, whatever it might be. I think it's the convergence of different solutions that enable a joined up mobility system, which, as much as it sounds a bit like a consultant sort of intellectual masturbation, forgive me for using the expression, but I think it can actually be a reality that we work towards, a bit like the 15-minute city that they talk about in some cases these days, a different way of thinking about our mobility.
Phenomenal. I mean, Ian, it feels like we're just getting started, because it feels like we can go this. I know that we have time. We'd love to chat. We have a little closing tradition on the EV Cafe podcast. You may or may not know about this closing tradition, but it's a very special one, and no podcast is any kind of podcast without a closing tradition. As is the EV Cafe magic wand with its lightning bolt. There you see it. And we now give you this magic wand for you to take and cast a spell, probably not the right kind of terminology, but, you know, make a wish. And so here we go. I'm handing you the magic wand now. It is over to you. And thank you very much for taking it. Tell us, Ian, what one wish would you give? I mean, it could be our industry. It could be for yourself. Somebody has used it entirely for themselves, completely selfishly. But it was quite funny. But what wish would you wish for?
I would love our industry to be more inclusive in every respect. I find it frustrating that we are making progress, but at too slow a pace. And there's three of us on this call. We're all three white males. The lack of female representation in the industry when I go to various events is still quite startling. We tried to do a lot in that regard to change things. We're lucky enough to benefit from a PLC board, which is majority female, two-thirds right now. Our operational leadership team is just about half female, not quite. Many other diverse communities represented in that environment as well. I think we are an outlier in that regard. We aren't saying that we're holier than thou by professing that, but we like to think we can be an actor of change. We also like to think we're an act of change in the sort of general responsibility theme. Our mission, our purpose, I should say, sorry, is defined as driving change together responsibly. And I mean, that means a lot of things. Driving change, we think we can always do better. The industry needs to keep moving forward. Together is all about working in partnership. We don't build cars. We don't sell cars. We help people that do those things to do those things better. And responsibly is all about maybe engaging with environmental challenges across the industry. If we're net zero, which we will be, it doesn't really have much impact. If we can help lots of other people to understand that the EV transition is all about the fact that we are part of an industry which is the biggest carbon emitter in the UK and in Europe and so on, therefore we need to be part of the solution, not the problem, then great. But all of that is all far more easily enabled if we are truly representative of the communities that we serve, the customers that we have, and the environment we all live in and belong to. Therefore, fundamentally, the one thing I'd start with, diversity, yes, broad in its broader sense, responsibility in its broader sense. One thing would be more female representation in automotive.
He's good, you know, isn't he? He is good. I've got three daughters, and I agree with you entirely. And Paul and I spend a lot of time when we're out on the road and going to shows with panels specifically to encourage young people, young women, to come into the industry. It really, really matters. And I think all of the things you've said, Ian, give me great heart. The frustration for me is that you spoke about politics right at the beginning of the podcast, and you said, yeah, I thought about politics, decided against it. My goodness, we need you, my friend. The country, the world needs more Ian Plummers, because your clarity of thought, your grasp of what's going on, and your vision for the future could make our world a heck of a lot better than it is right now. Outstanding.
That's very flattering, very kind of you to say. I'll console myself with thinking that bit by bit and in small increments, hopefully we can make a difference in how we work across automotive, in the partnerships we have and the things we do. Doing things for the right reasons in the right ways will generally deliver the right value for yourself, as in our business, as well as all our partners. That's the sort of value and the impact that I like to think I can have and that we can have more broadly. And we work with all our politicians in the UK, and we share a lot of EV insights to hopefully drive equally the right decisions at the broader level. So bit by bit, value add, impact here or there, we'll make things move in the right direction and hopefully get through that treacle we talked about earlier.
You're a treacle walker, my friend. You're getting through it. You're doing a grand job.
Ian, honestly, I'm you know, I've been smiling the whole time. It's been a real joy to get to know you a little bit, but also get the clarity of vision that you have. And I think, you know, if a vision is well articulated and clear, I think people can get on board with it. And there's no question in my mind that, you know, as a leader within your business, your vision is clear. You articulate it so well. So I really believe that Auto Trader, you know, as you comment, one of the biggest kind of automotive influential sites and businesses in the UK, is definitely going to lead on all these subjects. And increasingly so, seeing women in automotive and it's not just seeing women in automotive, is it? It's seeing women that are able to excel and influence and drive change. And, you know, I'm seeing that, and I'm just to give you some encouragement and hope. We've got a fleet electrification conference coming up, which I'm chairing a panel. It's on commercial vehicles, of course. Okay. It's entirely women, and I'm the only white, I'm the token white male in that particular instance, which is great. And it is sometimes a really hard thing to be an advocate for as a white male. You know, to sort of say, oh, no, go on, you know, promote women and promote diversity and inclusivity and all those kinds of things. I often find that quite a challenge because, you know, I want to do it. Anyway, we can talk about that because maybe you can give me some advice. No, that's how true. Best to support the industry as a middle-aged, white, balding male, in my case, not yours. You know, how do we truly, truly help other than give opportunity and make sure that, you know, we step out of the way when people are coming through? But
that's a whole new debate, that one. But it's definitely one that's worth having. So happy to join up if any opportunities arise to talk more about that particular subject. But there are lots of fantastic women in automotive as well that I could recommend you bring on to here and share their views. Because, like you say, luckily there are more coming through the ranks, getting to the very highest ranks. But equally, let's not forget, more than half of the people buying vehicles, I should say cars, but also vans, are women.
Yeah.
More than 50% of the driving license holders in the UK now are women. But aside from them and their own car buying for their own usage, they're very influential in the cars that maybe their husbands choose.
Oh, yes.
I don't know, mine is. So I think we forget that at our peril in our industry. And too often, literally, we do forget it.
Yeah, indeed. Well, it's a great point to leave it on, and to say, Ian Plummer, thank you so much for your insights today, for the positivity, the encouragement, the optimism, the vision for the future and the clarity of thought, and also a wish that is not only a wish, but a challenge also for us as an industry, and hopefully will resonate with many, many people out there.
My glass is half full. It's a great industry. It's a tenacious, resilient bunch of people we have in, whether it's retailer world or OEM world. They face challenges that get thrown at them every year. We keep saying, crikey, it's a time of change that we've never seen like this, like any other. Or, oh gosh, it's finance commission, it's COVID, it's supply chain issues and so on. But everyone battles through. It's a great place to work. It should likely stay that way. I'm very convinced it will do. So my glass is very much half full. I agree with you totally.
Fantastic. Can't summarise better than that, mate. That's good.
Well, everybody, please do kind of check out. There'll be links to Ian on LinkedIn. Check out Auto Trader if you haven't already. Where have you been? Under a rock? No, I'm sure that's not the case. I'm sure you've got you know who and where you might find Auto Trader. So, until next time, everybody, have a great day, and thanks for being here.